Okay, we'll just have a, short share today, because Usman didn't really begin yet. We are at the end of Perek Chafzayin. Still, do you want to get a set on yourself? Again, it's going to be a short shir tonight, and we're at the very end of Perek Chafzayin. There's a very, very interesting gra, although the gra l'chayr has almost no shaykhus to the pasuk at all. It might be the most famous thing that the gra says in the whole book of Mishlei, but let's first look at the psukim. But again, the shaykhus of the psukim is very, very tenuous. Perek Chafzayin, pasuk Chaf Gimel. Chapter 27, verse 23, is Yadoa Teda Pnei Tzaynecha. You shall pay very careful attention to your sheep, know your sheep well. Shis Libcha Liadorim. Put your heart, which means pay attention, to the flocks. Ki lo li'olam chosein. Chosein is wealth. Wealth does not last forever. V'imnezer v'dor v'dor, and glory does not go from one generation to another. So the simple shot is that be sure to take care of your resources, even financially, because things don't last forever. You think you have a lot of wealth and nothing's going to be a problem, right? This is the old joke they make about Aliyah. They say, how do you make $1 million in Israel? Says you come with 2 million, and that's how you make 1 million. So a person thinks, you know, I have plenty of money, I'll be fine. But things go through things very, very quickly. And then it goes on, and it uses the idea here, the example that Shlomo HaMelech uses. We'll see why. Is the example of sheep, which can do many good things for you. Livestock, gala chatzir, when the chatzir is the wild grass, because they can eat the wild grasses. You don't have to spend any money on their food. Gala chatzir, the wild grasses get revealed, they grow, v'nira desha, the vegetation sprouts, v'nesfu isfo sarim, and you can gather the grass that grows on the mountains, meaning you don't have to pay anything to feed them. And what do you get? Kivasim lil vushecha, you get lambs for your garments, meaning from the wool of the sheep we can make garments. U'mechir sada atudim, atudim are rams. You sell the rams and you can get money to buy a field. Right? Mechir sadeh from the atudim.
What's
a ram is a male sheep.
Not you sell the horn, you sell the whole animal.
The whole animal, yeah. Videi chalei vizim, and there will be sufficient milk of goats. Lelachmecha, to eat with your bread. Lelechem beisecha, and the bread of your household. V'chayim, and this will give life and sustenance, l'nairo secha, to your young girls, making them attractive for marriage, because they will have a healthy diet. Now, it's interesting, you know, it's interesting, just as a matter of choice. You know, I would have thought, you know, the reason we call land real estate is because land does not get destroyed. It's real. Every movable property can get destroyed. It's interesting, just in terms of Pashat Pshat, if Shlomo HaMelech is looking for an optimal investment vehicle, he seems to be choosing livestock. He seems to be choosing sheep and goats. I would have thought fields would be better, but he says the other way around. He says, through the sheep and the goat, you can earn income that will allow you to buy a field, but the sheep and the goat are good because they give you wool for your clothing, and they give you milk, and they give you meat. although he doesn't mention meat, because meat means you have to kill the animal, but he wants to talk about the renewability of the animal. So that would be the wool, and that would be the milk, and if you need to convert it to real estate, you can always liquidate the sheep, and you can buy real estate. So the simple meaning of this pasuk is that Shlomo HaMelech is giving us financial advice, which he sometimes does, and he's telling us to take care of our resources, pay attention, don't let things slide, don't trust your employees too much, don't trust your servants because they could do all sorts of things. We read in Pirkei Avos today, you know, the minhag is that we start learning Pirkei Avos from the Shabbos after Pesach, which was actually last Shabbos, at least in Eretz Yisrael. So today is the second parak of Pirkei Avos. So it mentions, marba avadim, marba gezel. The more avadim you have, the more theft you're going to have. And avadim cannot be trusted. So you have to pay careful attention to everything.
What's
avadim? Say again?
What's avadim?
Avadim are slaves.
Oh, okay.
You know, slaves. You can't really trust your slaves, your servants, because they could do all sorts of things.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's the simple pshat, that it's simply talking about paying attention to your property and your assets. And the truth of the matter is this has a religious dimension as well. The Gemara says in Maseches Chulin that tzaddikim, very strange Gemara, tzaddikim, chavivin lahem mamonam yaiser migufan. They care more about their money, their property, than even their body. And the proof of that is that when Yaakov Avinu was about to meet Esav, and the night before the great encounter, he had already moved all of his family to a safe place, and then he went back. That's when he encountered the mysterious angel of Esav that he wrestled the entire night. And he was all alone. And the Chumash doesn't say, why did he go back? Why did he go back to the place he had just vacated? And it says because he had left behind some small jars he wanted to retrieve. And it's tzaddik, is chaviv lemamonam, his property is more beloved to him, yoser migufam.
Shouldn't it be the other way around?
Well, yeah. I mean, what does it even mean? It's tzaddik cares about his money. It's tzaddik cares about small jars, insignificant property. But part of the answer is that a righteous person understands that there is nothing in his life that is extra or superfluous. Now, if you live for physical pleasure, there can certainly be a lot of things in your life that are just extra, like these people that buy 30 cars. Like, what exactly would they be missing if they only had 29 cars? You know? So there's plenty of stuff that's extra, you know? In fact, they say, I was reading an article, there's actually a school that trains you to be a butler in high class millionaires. You know, there's a whole training course on, you know, how to be a, it's a very good paying job, by the way. I mean, a butler in these millionaire homes could make $200,000 a year. You know, you run the household, it's not just a butler, you know. So it really is a position. And these are people that own, like, you know, 20 homes. And they say that sometimes they forget that they have a house, you know, in Vail, Colorado. They just forget they have a house there, you know, things like that, and the like. So, when you live for physical pleasure, by definition, there's a limit in how much physical pleasure you can get, so there's a lot of stuff that's extra. But a tzaddik knows that every single thing Hashem gave him can be used for Avodas Hashem. So if he has 5 pens, he needs all 5 pens for whatever the reason would be. Maybe to do chesed with it, to lend it out, whatever it would be. There's no such thing as something extra. I don't mean extra in the sense that you have to keep it for yourself, but there's always a purpose for something. Otherwise Hashem wouldn't give it to me. And therefore, Yaakov Avinu went back even for the pachim kitanim. That's why the Mefarshim say, when Yaakov describes his gashmias, Yaakov says, yesh li kol, I have everything. When Esav describes his gashmias, Esav says, yesh li rav, I have more than I need. Now you might think, right, you might think a tzaddik, you know, should also feel I have more than I need, but not really. A tzaddik understands that every single thing Hashem gives him has a tachlis, right? That's what the Gemara means, tzaddikim chavivin lahem amonam yoser migufin. So that's why there's an inner bal tashchis, you don't destroy things, you don't waste things. Now again, we don't mean to say that you have it for your own selfish purposes. It might be you have it for tzedakah, you have it for achnasas orchim, you have it to support Torah, but it has a purpose. It is not just a waste. It is not just a superfluous thing. So that's what Shlomo HaMelech is saying. Even on a simple pshat, you have to pay attention to the resources and the property that Hashem gave you, because that will be a basis, a way that you will serve Hashem in different ways. Yeah.
Tzaros works the same way, and Rasha says, "I have more tzaros than I need," and a tzaddik will say, "I have all the tzaros. I have just the right amount."
Yeah, l'char would be the same thing. The tzaddik understands whatever Hashem gives me is what's right for me. It's what's good for me. Now, the Gra, of course, takes it beyond the literal, and the Gra says that the reference to sheep over here is referring to Talmidim, that we look at a Rebbe, a teacher of Torah, as a shepherd. Any Rav, anyone that is a spiritual leader, so to speak. In fact, that's even the Goyim used that expression, a shepherd of the flock, as it were. And therefore the sheep are the Talmidim who learn, and the shepherd is, or the master of the sheep is the Rebbe or the teacher. And here it's making the point that Yadoa Teda Pnei Tzonecha. So look in Pasuk Chaf Gimel. There are two references. Know the face of your sheep and pay attention to the flocks. So the Gra says these are referring to two different relationships. The Tzonecha are the Talmidim who learn directly with the Rebbe. They're the Rebbe's sheep. He looks at their faces, face to face. Adorim is the broader community. Now again, this has great significance in terms of the Vilna Gaon's own life. You know, the Vilna Gaon was, of course, a phenomenal gadol, the gadol hador, the gadol of many generations before and after. And the Vilna Gaon was not a person that every single person who wanted to learn with the Vilna Gaon would go to the Vilna Gaon to learn with. I mean, the Vilna Gaon's madrega was beyond us. But the Vilna Gaon had a relatively small group of Talmidim who would learn with him. And the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon didn't have a yeshiva. He didn't start a yeshiva. The first great modern yeshiva was his Talmud, Rav Chaim Volozhin, who started the Volozhin yeshiva. But the Vilna Gaon himself was at home all day, basically. He was a homebody. And people would learn. Like, how many people? You walk into the Vilna Gaon's house. So most of the day, he just learned by himself. And when he had Talmidim, how many Talmidim were there? 10, 20 at most. Sometimes one or two. And yet, the Vilna Gaon was very, very, very concerned with the notion of Harbatzas Torah and a much wider circle. He organized many shiurim in Vilna and for Balabatim who were working, who were not Talmidei Chachamim, in Ein Yaakov, that's the Agadita of Gemara, or Chaye Yodam, which is written by his own brother-in-law. The Chaye Yodam is like a basic halacha, it's like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, it's a somewhat of a different sefer, but in Lita, in Lithuania, the Chaye Yodam was the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and the like. And the Vilna Gaon organized many, many, many shiurim, and in fact, it's interesting that he made a point, in order to encourage people to go, he gave the first shiur, only the first shiur. In other words, so imagine this. Let's take an Ein Yaakov shiur. An Ein Yaakov shiur was a shiur that was organized for working people. It was not an advanced shiur. It was about the Agada, the stories in the Gemara, and lav dafka deep meanings. People would just give pashut pshat. In fact, there's even an expression in Yiddish. When you talk about a sincere, frum person who did not go to yeshiva, he would be called, in Europe, an Ein Yaakov Yid. He's an Ein Yaakov Yid. It's a term of endearment. Sometimes it could be said insultingly, but generally speaking, it is a term of affection and a term of respect. An Ein Yaakov Yid. So imagine if you were a working person, you were a shoemaker, and between Mincha and Maariv, there would be a half an hour. And you would go and listen to the Ein Yaakov Shir. And you show up one day, and the Vilna Gaon is giving you an Ein Yaakov Shir. That's pretty amazing. I mean, the Vilna Gaon was not somebody, I mean, most people didn't even have a chance, even if you lived in Vilna, you didn't see him too often. I mean, he davened at home, I mean, everything was private. The Vilna Gaon did not go into the street that often. But imagine what it would be like. So he actually gave the first Ein Yaakov shir, and the first Chaye Yodam shir, the first Chumash and Rashi shir. So he says over here that these are the two concerns of someone who wants to be a teacher of Torah. On one level, you should have individual Talmidim that you learn with, that you inspire, that you train to be able to teach others. And they are called Sonecha. They are the sheep with whom you have a personal, individual connection. But then you try to create projects like ripple effects in which you take care of the flocks, even if they're anonymous, even if you don't know them. But you try to create mechanisms and structures where the Torah is going to be spread across many, many avenues. So, for example, you might say, well, the Vilna Gaon only had a few Talmidim, but remember that the Vilna Gaon's Talmud, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, started the Volozhiner Yeshiva, which in turn was the springboard for all the great yeshivas in Lithuania and Poland, whether it's Mir, Kamenetz, Baranovich, and those yeshivas are the forerunners of the yeshivas in America and in Eretz Yisrael. Right? So the Vilna Gaon, who was kind of a hermit, who lived in isolation, was really responsible for all of the Torah that is learned in the world now. I don't say all, because they came from Hasidic yeshivas as well, but really, virtually all of the Torah that is learned in the world comes directly or indirectly from the Vilna Gaon's influence. So these are the two ideas here, that on one hand, you have to have a relationship with your sheep, the Talmidim that you're personally metabol with, but then you also have to create a structure that will be Marbit's Torah to the Adarim, to the different flocks. Now you understand, a person has to make a cheshbon. It's not gaiva at all. A person has to make a cheshbon, where is his strengths best put? Now you could say, well, isn't it arrogant? Why didn't the Vilna Gaon teach Aleph Beis to people? You know? It's not that he wasn't willing to do that, but again, if it's something that many people could do, a person should put his kochos in where he's the most needed, where not everybody can do it, right? So if Rav Yashir, you know, didn't teach like the lowest shear somewhere, that's because there were many other people who could teach the lowest shear, so he taught something that only he could do. That's not a gaivadika thing. And by the way, we have many, many stories where simple balabatim would ask the Vilna Gaon a question, like how to read this word, and he was very happy. He was very happy to answer it, but he didn't like spend his whole day doing it, because that would have been a waste of his time. Not because it's not a mitzvah, it is a very great mitzvah. But if it's a mitzvah that somebody else could do, then you're mechuyev to use your kochos in those areas where you're the most needed. And where you're the most needed is those areas where there are fewer people who can do what you're able to do. Right? It's not a gaivit. People shouldn't. It's not like saying, "Oh, it's beneath his dignity to deal with simple questions." That wasn't it. Certainly, when those questions were asked, he did it, and he did it l'shem shemayim, and he did it l'shem mitzvah, as really any gadol will do. But it's not necessarily where he would put all of his time. I mean, I'll give you a chassidic example: Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe sends everybody to all over the world. Right? India, Thailand, you know, China. So why didn't he go to China? What is he sitting? You know, what is he sitting in Crown Heights, you know, in 770? He should become a shaliach and go to Cambodia and, you know, become a caravan. But the answer is, you know, okay, he'll go to Cambodia, he'll reach, you know, I don't know, 25, you know, people in 10 years, which is a wonderful thing. But, you know, but he's needed to direct. He's the general. I mean, why doesn't the general, you know, go and drive a tank? You know, the answer is because you need the general to coordinate the whole effort. So those are the two ideas here. That on one hand, you have to think about the whole campaign, which are the Adorim. At the other hand, you have to have a relationship with Sonecha, individual Talmidim as well. And he goes through different Ramazim, that all of these different references to clothing and to fields and to milk are really different parts of the Torah. He says the word kevasim, which with a sin means sheep, but if you read it with a shin, kevashim are hidden things, hidden. And that refers to the sodos of the Torah, the Kabbalah, that you keep under your shirt, under your garment, etc. The kevashim you keep hidden. The field, which is the pilpul of Torah, that's called like a field, that you can share with others, etc. Right? So there are different parts of the Torah. But here, Derech Agav, and again, it's very hard to see the connection, since it uses the phrase that wealth is not forever, And royalty does not go from generation to generation. Chosen is wealth, and Nezer is a royal crown. The Vilna Gaon brings the following idea from the Zohar. He says that there are two things that are called wealth. That there are trei, itrin, there are two crowns of royalty, and trei achsanim, and two types of wealth or inheritance. Now the two types of wealth or inheritance are called bayis vahon, a home and wealth. Right, so that those are both called yerusha, choset. A person's inheritance is the bayis, is the home, and the home and the wealth in the home, the money, the property, etc. And he says allegorically that refers to limud haTorah and mitzvos. Okay, the bayis are the mitzvos that you build, and the home, the wealth, is the Torah that you accumulate. And without mitzvos, that's yiras shamayim, you're not going to preserve your Torah, right? Your Torah is preserved in the bayis of the mitzvos that reflect yiras shamayim. Okay, so bayis vahon, the bayis is the yiras shamayim of mitzvos, and the hon is the wealth of limud haTorah. Those are called trei achsanim, two inheritances, bayis vahon, the mitzvos, and the Torah. But then we have trei itrin, two crowns, two ideas of melech. And he points out that you often find that references to melech are doubled. For example, when Yosef has a dream about he's a sheaf of grain and his brothers bow down to him, or the stars, right, the stars bow down to him. So the brothers say to him, Hamaloch timloch aleinu, shall you be king over us? Hamashol timshol banu, shall you rule over us? So note, there's a double usage there. Will you be our melech? Will you be our moshel? And the Vilna Gaon says, that is what the Zohar means when the Zohar says there are two types of melech, or two types of king. Now, what is the difference between a melech and a moshe? So a melech is someone whose subjects voluntarily submit to his authority. So a melech is not a dictator. A melech is someone that the nation has accepted as their melech. A moshel is someone who imposes his authority. Now, that could be for a few reasons. It could be because he's a dictator. Or it could be that he's just so much greater, so much more powerful, that he's the natural leader even if people don't want him. But it might be a good thing as well. But that's the nafka mina. Melech is with the haskama of the Am. Moshel is the imposition against the haskama of the Am, or at least some of the Am. So he says, this is the meaning, the Gra says, this is the meaning of the pasuk in Zechariah that we say at the end of Oz Yashir, Ki Lashem Hamlucha Umoshel Bagoyim. Lashem Hamlucha, which is Melech, is referring to Am Yisrael. We accept Hashem as our king. Every day, twice a day, we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We said at Matan Torah, Naseh V'Nishma, Hashem is our Melech, because we were Mamlechim. In fact, Rosh Hashanah itself is called the day, the Yom Hamlacha, or the Yom Hachtora, the day that we proclaim, we coronate Hashem. But Legabe the Umos HaOlam, that don't worship Hashem, Hashem is not their melech. That's very true. Hashem is not their melech. But Hashem for sure is their moshel, whether they like it or not. So that's the meaning of the pasuk, Ki Lashem Hamlucha, for us, Umoshel Bagoyim. And that is what, you know, the song Adon Olam, which I guess in our Aramaic we only say once a year, twice a year, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Okay, but in a lot of, you know, it's in the Siddur, number one, it's in the Siddur every day.
Every morning.
And many, many shuls also sing it, or have a child sing it Friday night or Shabbos morning, whatever it would be. But Adon Olam is actually a very beautiful song. In fact, there's even a word from the Gran, Adon Olam. Somebody brought him a siddur with a peirush on it, and there was a vort in the beginning of the peirush that says, "Why is Adon Olam said at the beginning of Shachris?" So this peirush said, because the Gemara in Brachos says that Avram Avinu was the first person who called Hashem by the title Adon, Master, and since Shachris was misukken by Avram Avinu, in the beginning of Shachris, we use the shame that Avraham Avinu was innovated.
He also because,
that's right. Avraham Avinu was like in Shachris, right. So the Gra says, I don't know if the Gra read any further, like you could have read it in a minute if you wanted to, but the Gra said, says, even if that's the only thing you said in the Siddur is Kedai. He gave a Haskama, he says. That's already, the Gra liked this word a lot. He said, that's an emet stick of words. Okay, anyway. But Adon Olam was. Yeah.
Well, okay. But with the Shvatim, so how come they asked Yosef? It seems to
me. I'll come back. I'll call you. I'll come back to the Shvatim. I'll come back to what it means over there. So in Adon Olam was written by a great Jewish philosopher and poet, Rav Shlomo ibn Gabarel. It was around the time of the Ibn Ezra, earlier than the Ibn Ezra, around the 1000s. And he wrote Adon Olam, and what does it say? It says, Adon Olam Asher Malach. It's not quite the Vilna Gaon's word, but it's going to be similar. Adon Olam Asher Malach Beterem Kol Yitzir Nivra. You, Hashem, ruled before there was any creations, but Lies Nasa Bechefzokol, but only after you made your creation, Azai Melech Shemon Nikra, that is when you could be called a melech. Because when you ruled over the, and it's not quite the Gra because it does say Asher Malach, according to the Gra, but the concept is that even Adon Olam is making the point that until there are human beings who are Balei Bechira, see, even angels cannot be Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because Hamulacha requires Bechira. Because angels have to do what they do, right? So Mamela, that's what. Now, with Yosef, therefore, he said, going back, Amaloch Timloch Aleinu, Im Mashal Timshol Banu. So the Gra says the following. They're telling Yosef both things. First of all, if you think we're going to accept you as king, you got another thing going. And if you think you're better than us and you'll make yourself king, that's not going to work either. They're kind of saying both things. You know, don't expect us to accept you, and don't think you're better than us that you can make yourself a king. Now, Elibid Yemes, Yosef actually accomplished both things. Yosef, number one, was in a position where he could force himself on them, but then he also accepted him as the king. Once he revealed himself, they accepted himself as the king. Right, so this is a very, very famous, this comment, although as they say, it's seems to be only peripherally connected to the psukim themselves, but this comment is a very, very famous yusayit of the Gra that we often talk about on Rosh Hashanah. That, you know, Rosh Hashanah, the whole theme of Rosh Hashanah is Malchus. Part of the Musaf is Malchios, verses of Malchus, that we say 10 verses in Musaf, 3 from the Torah, 3 from the Ksuvim, 3 from the Nevi'im, and then 1 from the Torah, again, 10 psukim, to be Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And although the emes is, Musaf has 3 parts with that format, we have Malchios, verses of kingship, we have Zichronos, verses of God remembering, and Shofaros, verses of Shofar, but in reality, all three sections are aspects of God's Malchus. Rav Yosef Albo writes in the Sefer HaIkarim that there are 3, unlike the Rambam that says there are 13 principles of faith, Rav Yosef Albo says there are 3 principles of faith. And these are called Ikarim. These are called fundamental principles. And the rest is called Anafim, branches. And the three principles of Rav Albo is Mitzios Hashem, that there is one God who created heaven and earth. And the other things that the Rambam says, that he's not physical, those are details. In other words, they're not Ikarim per se, they're details within the idea of Mitzios Hashem. Now the second principle, according to Rav Yosef Albo, is Sechar V'Yonesh, that Hashem rewards good and punishes evil. But what form that will take, Moshiach, Techiyas HaMesim, Olam Haba, Rav Albo says that's not Iker, meaning to say, if I don't, well, let's say I would not believe in Moshiach, Chas V'Shalom. Let's say I only believe in Olam Haba. According to the Rambam, such a person is an apikoros, such a person is a heretic. Because according to the Rambam, Mashiach and Techiyas HaMesim is an Iker Emunah. It's a Yesod of Emunah. According to Rav Yosef Albo, here is what Rav Yosef Albo would say. If I don't believe in Mashiach, but I believe that the Neshama will be rewarded by God, I am mistaken, because there is Mashiach, is true. Rav Albo doesn't deny, people misunderstand it. Rav Albo does not deny Mashiach, but he just says, people who labor under certain mistakes are not automatically heretical. So according to Rav Albo, if I believed that after a person dies, there's no Schar V'Onesh at all, that would be heresy. But if I believe there is Schar V'Onesh, but I'm not a maimon in the particular form of Mashiach, or I don't believe in Techiyas HaMesim, I believe only the Neshama gets reward. So again, I want to emphasize, that is a mistaken belief. But Rav Albo's chiddush is, not every mistaken belief is a heretical belief. And therefore, the Iker is Schar V'Onesh, whether it's Olam Haba, whether it's Mashiach, whether it's Techiyas HaMesim, those are branches. Those are not roots. And the third principle is Torah Min HaShemayim, that the God communicated His will. Because you see the following. If I just believe that Hashem is a creator, but maybe Hashem created the world and doesn't care about good and evil. Hashem azav es haaretz. So I need Schar V'Onesh to remind me that God didn't just create the world and abandon it, but that He cares about how I behave. But even if you just have the first two principles, there is a God, and God cares about good and evil. But without revelation, what is the definition of good and evil? Is it whatever I want to do? Whatever the New York Times says, whatever Ma'ariv or Jerusalem Post? So revelation says that good and evil is not subjectively defined, but it's defined by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. These are the three fundamental principles. There is the God that created us. God did not just create us, but He is actively concerned about how we live our lives, reward and punishment. And number three, He is not only concerned with how we live our lives, but He gave us the standard by which we will know how to live our lives. That is Torah Min HaShemayim. So Rav Albo goes on to say that this are the three components of the Musaf on Rosh Hashanah. Malchios, God is the king because He created heaven and earth. Zichronos, He remembers goodness and sin, and it makes a difference. And three, Shofaros is the shofar of Matan Torah. So really, if you think about it, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros are all aspects of recognizing the Malchus of Hashem. In other words, Zichronos and Shofaros are also, that's why Rosh Hashanah overall is Malchios. That is why Melech al Kol Haaretz. So it turns out though, that what makes Hashem a Melech, Hashem is not intrinsically a Melech. Hashem is a melech because we are a mekabel him. If you're not mekabel him, he's a moshel. He's not a melech. It's Hashem's ratzon to be a melech. And that's exactly what the pasuk means now. V'haya Hashem l'melech al kol ha'aretz. When Mashiach comes, Hashem will be the melech on the whole world. What do you mean, will be the melech on the whole world? He's the melech on the whole world right now. The answer is no. He is the moshel on the whole world right now. But he's not the melech until we accept, till everyone accepts him as the melech.
Now, long live the king. This is what it
is. That's right, that's right. Now, philosophically, one needs to understand it. Perhaps you can only understand it in a mystical level. Why is it intrinsically so important for God? Like, in other words, God has infinite power. But it's the Ratzon Hashem that we will be mekabel him. Like, exactly why is that so important? What exactly is chaser in Hashem being a moshel and the like? You know, even Matan Torah was that way. You know, it's interesting that the Maral says the following. It's actually a little short from the Gemara. The Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu held a mountain over our heads. Kafa Lam Har Kikigas. It said, if you accept the Torah, that's great. If not, I'm going to crush you under this mountain, and you're going to die. And we accepted the Torah, and the Gemara in Megillah seems to indicate that it was under duress, under coercion. Until Purim, we had a way out, because we could have said we were forced into it. So Tosfos asked the Kasha, how can we say that the Jewish people were forced into the Torah? Are they not praised? Because they said, Nasa v'nishma. I mean, if they said it because they were forced, that wouldn't mean anything. In other words, Nasa we will do even before we know what it is. All the nations of the world, when they're asked, do they want the Torah? They said, tell us what it is first. And when it was something they didn't like, they said, no. The Jewish people didn't even ask. Nasa v'nishma. Right? The godless of Nasa v'nishma means, we will do, and now we will try to hear what it is. So it's a stira. How can you say Hashem forced us? Nasa v'nishma. So Tosfos gives an answer, which is very fascinating, because Tosfos's answer is that initially we said Nasa v'nishma. Initially we said Nasa v'nishma. But when all of the fire and the lightning, we got scared and we were going to change our mind. So the mountain over our head was, don't change your mind. Better not change your mind or I'll crush you. So Memela, the Etzem Kabbalah Satira was Beratze, but the Har Kigigis was just so we shouldn't be Choser from our Ratze. That's one answer. There's another answer Tosis gives, which is actually an answer in the Medrash Tanchuma. Tosis does not bring it in the name of the Medrash, but it is a Medrash, that there's a difference between Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh. The written Torah, we accepted willingly. It was the oral Torah that we had to be forced, because number one, the oral Torah is harder, meaning it has more restrictions, right? So the written Torah says, you know, don't do work on Shabbos. Okay, well, what if, you know, going to the beach is not work for me? You know, I mean, the person might, without the Lamites Melachos, you could do a whole bunch of stuff on Shabbos. Although it's interesting that the Tztukim and the Karoyim, who followed the written Torah, they actually were stricter in some aspects of Shabbos. They didn't leave their houses, etc. Okay. Also, the oral Torah requires yegia, work and toil to understand, etc. So that they were forced into. But the Maral gives another mahalach. The Maral says the following. The Maral says, it's a davar pashut that the Jews accepted the Torah willingly. They accepted the Torah willingly. Because if they would have been forced into it, it would have had no purpose at all. So of course they accepted it willingly. After they accepted it, Hashem then says to them, Baruch Hashem, you made the right choice. Because had you not made the choice, the whole purpose of this universe would have been gone. In other words, here's the thing. Hashem couldn't tell them that their decision, the whole universe depended on their decision. If Hashem would have told them that, it would have been a forced decision. If it would have been a forced decision, it would be a meaningless decision. They made the decision and then became aware after the fact of the consequences of their decision. In other words, the purpose of the universe was that the Jewish people should voluntarily accept Hashem's kingship. And had they not voluntarily accepted Hashem's kingship, the world would be kaput. That's the meaning of kafale markigigas, meaning to say the world would have ceased, the universe would have ceased to exist. That somehow the tachlis of the world is that either the Jewish people are really Adam, generally, Jewish people became the representatives of Adam, except Hashem's Torah. This is the idea of Melech and Moshe. Because Hashem is a Moshe without a physical universe. Right? Well, there's no reason to create this world to make Hashem a Moshe. He was a Moshe before anything. But Hashem wants there to be a Melech. Again, we don't fully, without... And on a purely rational level, it's hard to understand why this is so important. But the whole dynamic of the universe is that there should be a free will decision to be Makabel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the way Matan Torah works, and that's how the Maharal understands the Kafa Aleihem Har Kigigas, that the mountain was over their heads. That did not coerce them into making a decision. That was to inform them, after they made the decision, how important that decision was. That had they not made that decision, there would be no purpose for this world. But again, it's a little short. The morale is a little difficult, because according to the morale, it's hard to understand why the Gemara says that until Purim, they had a way of getting out by saying we were forced into it. According to the Maharal, they were not forced into it, right? So that's going to be a bit of a difficulty. Yeah, did you want to say something? Yeah.
That's how Geras works also.
That's right, that's right, that's right. In fact, it's very interesting that in fact, Matan Torah is conversion. The laws of conversion are derived from Matan Torah. With one big exception. It's interesting. The Maharal in the Gerari is the Maharal's Perish on Rashi. It's actually the first sefer the Maharal wrote, or at least the first that was published. And the Maharal raises the interesting question, because he discusses this as part of a broader question, and that is, you know that the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given. They knew with Ruach HaKodesh what the mitzvahs were. And even though they were not yet commanded, they kept all of the mitzvahs. So one of the very famous questions is, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? Yaakov married Rachel and Leah. Now the Torah does permit polygamy. You are allowed to marry more than one wife. That only became forbidden in the time of Rabbeinu Gershom for Ashkenazim. So Yaakov could be Sephardic, whatever it would be. but the question is, even when the Torah permits more than one wife, you cannot marry a wife and her sister. You can't marry Achos Isha. So L'chari Rachel V'Leia are Achos Isha. That's Akasha. So Ramban says in Yesod, that the Avos kept the whole Torah only when they lived in Eretz Yisrael, because they were in the palace of the king. When they did not live in Eretz Yisrael, they felt free not to keep the Torah. They were not bound. And since Yaakov married Rachel and Leah in Chutz La'aretz, in Syria, in Aram Naharayim, so even when he came back, he didn't have to separate. Although it's interesting, Ramban says that may be why Rachel died as soon as they came back, because once he's in Eretz Yisrael, he shouldn't have two sisters. This is a very big yisayid of the Ramban, that the Avos kept the whole Torah only in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutz La'aretz, even though we're talking about a mitzvah that's not Tluya B'aretz, right? Arayas is not Tluya B'aretz, but before Matan Torah, they only kept it in Eretz Yisrael. Maral doesn't like that teretz, because Maral says, Arayas has no shaykh, Arayas is not limited to Eretz Yisrael, so why would you say they only did it in Eretz Yisrael? So Maral suggests another answer, which he seems to bring from somebody else. When he doesn't say it as his own answer, but he doesn't indicate who said this. And that is that when Rachel and Leah joined Yaakov's family and they repudiated the Avodah Zarah of their background, they became like Gerim. And when people convert, they sever the family relationship. And indeed it is the case that if two women convert on a Doraisa level, two sisters convert, I could marry both sisters. Not only that, a mother and a son who convert, the mother could marry the son, a father and a daughter who converts, a brother and a sister who converts. Doraisa, Midrabanan it says. This is Gershon Iskarkan Shanay L'dami. So it might be that Rachel and Leah became Gerim, and therefore there was no Isra of Achais. Now again, a genetic counselor would not advise a mother and a son marrying, but in terms of Hilchos Geiris, it's permitted. So then the Maral then says the following. If this is so, then why, at the time of Matan Torah, would there be any prohibition of Arayas? All the Jewish people became Gerim. So L'chaira, the day after Matan Torah, let a brother marry a sister. And yet, it seems to be the Yisurim of Arayas were in place right away. So here, the Gor Aryeh says a very interesting chiddush. He says, even though it's true that Matan Torah is a Geiris, it is the only Geiris where you don't say Gershon Iskayer Kikatan Shinoi Ladomi. It's a Geiris that does not erase family relationships. So maybe the Geiris of Rachel and Leah may have erased a family relationship, but the Geiris of Matan Torah did not. Now, what the Gor Aryeh says is the following. I'm going to explain it, but let me first tell you what he says. He says, because when do I say Gershon Iskayer Kikatan Shanai Lad Dami? That's only if it's a voluntary Geiris. But since the Geiris of Matan Torah was an involuntary Geiris, because the mountain was held over their heads, when you have an involuntary Geiris, you don't say Gershon Iskayer. Now, in truth, this is what they call a subset of one, because there is no such thing as an involuntary Geiris, except for that one. So that's the only one. Now, the only question is, you may say, well, wait a second here. Doesn't this contradict the Maral? I mean, I just told you another Maral, a different Maral, that said that Bedafka, it wasn't involuntary. That Fakert, it was voluntary. So how can he then turn around and say, Matan Torah is involuntary? So, you have to look at the words a little more, but I would suggest when the Maral says involuntary, he means something a little different. He means like this. Involuntary doesn't mean we were forced into it, but it means it was something we had to do, in the sense of the following. The reason why a ger cuts off their past is because they are repudiating their past. They're cutting themselves off from their prior life, so it erases it. With the Jewish people, we are reconnecting to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Matan Torah did not cut us off from our past. It reconnected us to what the others were doing. So when the Maral says it was a forced conversion, he doesn't mean forced in the sense of compulsion, but he means forced is it was our nature. Our nature is to embrace the Torah, and therefore we're not cutting ourselves off from our past. We are reconnecting to our past. Right? This is what the Gur Aryeh says in Parshavikas. Now, Lemaisa, the Maral himself, gives, in other words, so far I mentioned two answers. One is Ramban, that they only kept the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. The second is Rachel and Leah were like Gerim. The Maral's own answer is very interesting. Maral says, this answers a whole bunch of questions, that when we say the Avos kept the whole Torah, they only kept positive commandments. like tefillin, whatever it be. But the negative commandments they felt free to ignore. There was a good reason for them. This answers a whole bunch of things. How could Avram give the angels meat and milk? You know. Basically, you'll notice all of the kashas people ask, there's a whole series of questions, are always on the negative commandments. And the Maral says that the words kiyem kol haTorah, kiyem is always a reference to mitzvah saseh, not mitzvah lo saseh.
Aren't mitzvahs lo saseh more strict than saseh?
Yeah, they are more strict. But here's what the Maral says. The Maral makes the point that keep in mind that they were not commanded to do anything, right? So if they kept mitzvah saseh, they were doing it as eino mitzvah. You're not commanded, but you're doing it anyway. So the idea that doing something you're not commanded to do is a merit is only for asay, not a los asay. I mean, let me give you a simple example. If a woman wants to take a lulav and a nesrug, a woman is exempt. A woman is pukur because it's what's called a time-bound positive commandment. But if she takes a lulav and a nesrug, she gets reward in Shemayim as doing a mitzvah, even though she's not commanded. And in fact, Ashkenazim even paskin, she could even make a bracha, sher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. Right? So when you do mitzvahs you don't have to do, you get rewarded. Now, let's take a negative commandment. A kohen is not allowed to marry a divorced woman. Okay, that's in the Torah. I'm not a kohen. Let's say I decide I am not going to marry this really great divorced woman who's right for me because I voluntarily want to fulfill the mitzvah of a kohen not marrying a divorced woman. Is Hashem going to reward me because I didn't marry a divorced woman because I'm doing the mitzvah of a kohen? The answer is no. Now you might ask, well, I don't get it. If a woman wants to take lulav and esrog, she gets the reward as an eino mitzvah v'yaseh. If a man doesn't want to marry a grusha, why can't he get a reward as an animal? The answer is that for Losa says, if you have the commandment, you got to keep it. If you don't, it doesn't mean anything. So, Mimela, the concept would be, for the Avos, the Maral says, to keep negative commandments wouldn't be an inyan because they were not Mitzvah V'yaisa. Of course, there is a caution that the Maral himself goes into the Gemara and Pesachim. Narvi Pesachim has a whole Agadata about, in the Seuda of Mashiach, right, there's a Seuda, right, we say with that, it's not really Mashiach, but in Olam Haba, we have the meal of Livyasan, a big, big meal of Livyasan, and the Shor Habor, the wild ox, right, a whole big meal. So the Gemara, again, obviously it's metaphorical for spiritual ideas, but the Gemara takes the physical analogy, Vayter, and says, okay, when it's time to bench, who's going to lead the benching? And it discusses all the different candidates who should lead the benching. And they're all ruled out until David HaMelech, who says, Kos Yeshua Sessa, V'Shem Hashem Ekra, David HaMelech leads the benching. But one of the candidates who is going to be honored with benching is Yaakov Avinu. But Yaakov Avinu gets rejected because he married two sisters. So the Maral himself asks on himself, I mean, we just said there was no problem. So what is Yaakov getting rejected for? The Maral says, still, it's a little bizoyon that Yaakov did something that later turned out to be usher, even though B'shas Maisa, it wasn't. By the way, Moshe Rabbeinu himself, if you think about this is something that maybe we shouldn't even say. Moshe Rabbeinu's parents, right? His father was Amram, and his mother was Yocheved. Now Yocheved is the daughter of Levi. Amram is the son of Kahath, who is the son of Levi. So Yocheved was the sister of Amram's father. Yocheved was Amram's aunt. Now, Achos Aviv, to marry Achos Aviv, is an erva after Matan Torah.
Is that an aunt?
It's an aunt, yeah. Aunt. Yeah. It's not.
It's
Mutter? No. It's usher. It's an erva. It's a forbidden relationship.
No.
But before the Torah was given, it was allowed. It's not forbidden under the Noahide laws. It's forbidden. Mm-hmm. Now the halacha is, if a nephew marries his aunt, not only is it a forbidden relationship, but the child is a mamzer. meaning the child's an illegitimate child, which means someone born like Moshe Rabbeinu was born, had this happened after Matan Torah, would have had a psul of Mamzeris Mamish. It would have been Mamzeris Mamish. And yet we see that obviously Amram is not only was it Mutter, but Amram is actually described as in Chazal as one of the people who had no sins at all. Amram is more righteous than Moshe. Moshe has, you know, whatever, one Aveira. Amram had nothing. Right? Amram was absolutely pure. And yet Amram did something that after Matan Torah would have had a din of Arayos Mamish. Moshe Rabbeinu would have been a monster, but before it was before Matan Torah, it wasn't a problem. Yeah.
Why would Hashem choose such a union to bring about Mashiach?
Yeah, it's a very very good question. But well, it's not Mashiach. Well, Moshe is not Mashiach, but just the
Moshe. But isn't he Mashiach? He brought out us from Israel.
Maybe Mashiach in the sense of
well, okay, he was a redeemer. Yeah, he was. Yeah, okay. It's not. I mean, we don't call him Mashiach, but certainly he was Moshiyan Shel Yisrael. He is called the Redeemer of Israel. Once again, part of it is it may be connected to the idea the same way that the Drasha Saran says that Moshe Rabbeinu was a stutterer, so that people should not be taken in by charisma, and they shouldn't describe Moshe Rabbeinu as being the one that's doing everything. They should all know it comes from Hashem. So too it was necessary for Moshe to be of what you might call a humble origin, just as David HaMelech himself comes from all sorts of problems in his background.
No, the thing is, Hashem finds error disgusting. That's why for us, it's harder to do error.
Yeah.
The person is harder for me uh-huh. to marry his sister.
Right.
But Hashem chose about this union between Amram and his aunt to bring about Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem could have chosen a union that's more.
No, but the Gemara says in a lot of places, the Gemara says that that Hashem will often pick for Malachim people that come from a very difficult background, because that gives them humility and that prevents people from looking at them as the source of their salvation. They know it comes from Hashem. I mean, the Gemara says by David HaMelech also, it comes from Yehuda and Tamar, and ultimately Rus is descended from the incest of Lot and his two daughters, right? And Rus is the great-grandmother of David, and therefore the ancestor of Mashiach. So the Gemara in Yuma says that Malchus often requires what is called a kupa shel shrutim, which literally means a bag of dead animals, but we would call it skeletons in the closet, is the language that we would have it. Yeah.
This is why Moshe sends his wife back to Yitro. Because
yeah, because what?
Because
it's
not really glad that he's marrying
a girl. Well, that's yet another issue, that Moshe Rabbeinu marries a Giyaris. But again, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with marrying a Giyaris. But once again, it was not right. It was not the most prestigious wedding that you would assume. It's all connected. And again, the Ran makes the point. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu was a kavad peh. That people should not think it was his charisma that took him out. That is why the Haggadah, as you know, the Haggadah does not mention Moshe Rabbeinu's name, except incidentally by Kriyas Yamsuf, V'yar Yisrael Esayed Agdola, V'yaminu Bashem Uva Moshe Avdo. That's the one, only one time. But the Haggadah really de-emphasizes Moshe Rabbeinu. All of it is that we should know that the Geula comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. All right, so we finished Perek of Zayin now. I guess we'll stop now. Unfortunately, I have to go to Chutz Laaretz for a few weeks, actually. So I'm not going to be back the rest of the month of May. So I'll be back, Mir Sashem, we'll be back June 1st. Okay, so whatever week that's going to be. Okay.
Yeah,
thank you.